Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send us an email or favorite recipe, please contact us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, they are archived on that website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time we're going to be talking about knowing when we have it. Yeah, knowing what we want. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the key things that we help groups, that we help participants, that we help the various sides know. What is it that we want? Because we have to know that. We have to know what success looks like before we can go off and try to get it, try to create success, try to reach consensus. The answer is consensus on what? Yes. And surprisingly enough, and yes, I see a lot of you have had this experience also, and thank you all for being here. We have lots of participation. Surprisingly enough, that is one of the main problems, especially with groups that have been faltering. A lot of times professionally I'm called in when the negotiations have bogged down, right? Yeah, people are failing to reach consensus. They've reached kind of, kind of discord. We won't call it animosity, but sometimes it amounts to that. And one of the reasons that happens is they've got turned around. They don't know what they want. And you have to decide that as a group, first and foremost, what it is that we want. Now, it may indeed change as we progress and as life happens, right? Mm-hmm. And things, circumstances may change. But what is it that we want on a real core basis so that we know what we're working towards, for heaven's sakes? Yes, yes, it is true. Yes, a lot of people are agreeing that it is surprising how often people don't know success looks like. How will we know when we have it if we don't know it? Yes, what success looks like. Mm-hmm. So I think our first question is going to be, how do we determine what we want within our context, within the context of a negotiation, an alternative dispute resolution, even a workshop and a seminar and a consensus building, right? Any kind of negotiation and any kind of being taught what to do, right? We need to know what we want to learn, what we want to resolve, right? Yes. When I come in and I do workshops and seminars, it's not a canned thing. Now, it is true that I have a PowerPoint presentation, don't we all? But it's not just notes, words on the screen that I really hate it when people do that, don't you? Yes. That just says what I'm going to say. No, it's a presentation about conflict so that we can all talk about it within the context of what we need to learn, of what we are there for, about what we want to know, right? Yeah. Yes, thank you. It's kind of unscripted in that way, just like this show is, yes, because the questions, the comments, take us where we need to go so that we can get our answers. Yes. So how do we determine what we want within our context? Yeah, how do we know how? Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Lots of people, Alex and others, are talking about an open group discussion, right? An open group discussion. We need to be able to talk about it. We need to have a safe zone. Sometimes, in fact, frequently, I do large corporations, and my participants have been assigned to come, and they are from different areas within the organization, right? And sometimes they're reticent because they're going to see each other again and they're going to deal with each other again. Sometimes they are reticent to speak openly. Mm-hmm. And we make the negotiation a safe zone, the group a safe zone. And also, you know, I'm not adverse to someone telling me as leader something that they don't want to be the person who says it out loud in the group, right? But it needs to be known. I make that very clear that I am available and I will not breach confidentiality, right? Because sometimes we all need to know something. We all need to consider something. And someone knows it and it's important. But they don't want to be the one who brings it up. It's kind of like not being the bearer of bad news. It's usually some sort of a complication, some sort of a reason why the path that we're on, the discussion that we're having, what we're about to do, has got some sort of an impediment that none of us thought of, and those in the perhaps higher in the organization strata don't know about, but it's going to bite us. We need to know. And I make it very clear that you can tell me, tell it to me, explain it to me, explain why, explain what. Yes, thank you. Explain the five questions, right? The 5W questions that we're about to say is one of the most important things we need to determine what we want within our context. What do we want? Let's ask the 5W questions when somebody brings up issues, right? Has issues, is not perhaps with the group exactly on what we want, right? Yes, the 5W questions. Who, what, where, and why? Who, what, where, when, and why? Excuse me, that was four, right? Who, what, where, when, and why? They will get us to the bottom of it, to the to the basis for the opinion, for the statement, for the idea. And then we can decide if we need to take that into account. And I bet you we do. Yes. Who, what, where, when, and why? Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's important to ask these questions. Even now, people are asking me, and thank you all for being here, whether or not you ask those questions in front of the group. And I'm going to say what you guys say. I say a lot. I'm going to say it depends, because it is a leadership judgment call, right? It is my general nature, unless if it might be the slightest bit personal or not, you know, somebody has to think about it. It is my nature to start those questions during the break privately, mm-hmm. So that we can get down to it and then we can answer the questions publicly in front of everyone when we've really had a chance to refine the answer and think about it. Sometimes the who, what, where, when, and why just comes out naturally in the conversation, right? That's different. It's not potentially embarrassing is what it really is. I don't like to embarrass people in front of their peers, the other participants, unless I'm actually applying peer pressure, right? Because the civility rules have been breached, or they're about to be breached. It's the main reason that I do that. And yes, the civility rules, thank you, Rafi. The civility rules are pretty much the only rules that the Recipe for Peace now has. And they say at their very base, we will not be rude to one another, right? And depending on the group, You can have them written down. You can do a whole list that changes with each group, right? Basically, it's the same, but it gets kind of tweaked. Or they can be implied if it's a very group that's all kind of in step with each other and you don't need to actually say the civility rules will be enforced, right? It depends how your participants, what the group dynamic is. If you enforce the civility rules, we will not be rude to each other. We will not take each other's turns. We will give everybody their ability to voice their opinion. And like that, if you enforce the civility rules immediately and prevent bullying of any sort, and men, you think of men when you say the word bully, but women do it too. If you prevent that, you prevent the sarcasm, the bullying, the rolling of the eyes, and like that, you enforce them right away and fairly, right away and to everyone, your group dynamic will get better. It really will. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is somewhat leadership style. People are talking about leadership style and how do we determine what we want. As you get more experienced, you will kind of get a leadership style, right? Mine's kind of all-inclusive, let's talk this out, and like that. But sometimes you need to modify your leadership style. Now, I deal substantially in the United States. Even in the United States, though, sometimes I have multinational groups that need to get together, that need to reach consensus, that need to go forward. And sometimes, especially if you're called in after the group has faltered, sometimes you need a more strict, a more take-charge leadership style than others. You get a feel for that from the group dynamic. I get a feel for it right away if I see the civility rules are in danger, right? I see that there's hostility, there's animosity. Yes, yes. You know, it is a good point. Quite a few people are mentioning, and thank you all for your participation, are mentioning the fact that I'm a woman, and that leads to maybe a different leadership style than a man. I don't know if it's such a different leadership style, although I suspect the kind of embracing all-inclusiveness might be somewhat a feminine trait. But sometimes also being an outsider, you have to assert your leadership. Being a outsider woman with different cultures, you might need to assert your leadership, right? Right. And you do this right away. I do it by enforcing the civility rules and by giving instruction, right? And I'm very, very transparent. It doesn't change. My leadership style changes depending on the situation. And yours should too, within certain parameters. You know what I mean? If I might not be the right person if you need a truly totalitarian leadership style, right? I might not be. That's kind of far away from my core. Mm-hmm. I sometimes start out like that because I understand that the participants need to sit up straight and pay attention because there's a new sheriff in town, right? There's a new leader, and the old way is gone, and the new way will get us to our destination. As we acclimate to each other, I do indeed oftentimes modify as I see we're doing okay, and we're doing our assignments, and we're going forward, right? And the process is going forward. I am always very transparent about the process. I tell people what's happening, what's going to happen, what we need to do, right? Yeah, we discuss it because there are different kinds of ways of doing things, right? Right. But I do keep people in civility line. If that is a, it's a real priority. It's a leadership priority is what it is. Yes, to keep people civil to each other and to keep the negotiation going to get us to reach consensus. So, yes, so different leadership styles for different groups. Mm-hmm. Some groups, some cultures really, really want and expect the leader to take charge. They want to follow. They have confidence in your experience and in your abilities, and they want you to take charge and go forward. They want more leading and following than others. I've noticed this is kind of a cultural trait too. It's just a way that it's a way that people have been brought up. They've had schooling and stuff where people tell them things and lead them and give them assignments, and they're comfortable with it. And some groups want to do it all kind of democracy. They want to discuss everything. And the leader's job is to keep them from kind of just going around in circles chasing their tails and getting off focus. So it's a question of focus, but it's a question of leadership style too. Sometimes you just take charge, and sometimes you have to kind of corral them so that they don't keep going off focus and off path, so they'll never get to the destination. Yeah, and it's a very different type of a group. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a leadership style that you employ because of the group dynamic. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how else do we determine what we want? Mm-hmm. Quite a few people, Kyle Paul and others, are talking about creating a mission statement even if the goal seems obvious. Yeah, Alex and Kyle Paul and other people are really voting for that. Creating a mission statement even if the goal seems obvious so that we know what we want. I know that those of you who have been here before, and thank you all for returning. And welcome to the new people. I think a mission statement is a mighty fine thing. I don't think it's always necessary. You have to determine that depending on the group, and that's a leadership question. The reason that I don't always do it is simply because it takes time. And if we all are in agreement about the goal and what needs to be done, I don't think we need to bother with the wording of the mission statement. A very general one doesn't really do much. A very specific one is going to need modification as we go along, I think, usually. Yeah? Yeah, so it's an exercise. It's a group-building exercise, a team-building exercise. In that respect, I like a mission statement. Yeah, it's a team builder. Sometimes it is necessary to make a mission statement, right, and a listing of goals and like that. If you're going for a grant, for example, for fundraising, the grant writer, the person who's doing the actual paperwork and like that, needs to know what your mission is and needs to be clearly stated, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is true. Those of you who have seen me in person know that Recipe for Peace Now has a little statement that goes with it that I say to people when they say, what do you do, right? And it's our mission statement. It has been thought about, and it is one sentence that was indeed kind of hashed out so that we could say what we do. Yes, here we go. Recipe for Peace Now positively changes lives one conversation at a time by teaching mediation, negotiation, and civil discourse skills around the world. Yeah. Yes, that's what we do, indeed. Is that a mission statement? Well, yeah, it kind of is. It's what we do. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. People are saying it's an explanation, but you see, we needed to be able to tell people what it is that we do in one sentence because people ask. So that kind of a thing is worth paying some attention to when you need it. But just to do it because somebody says to do a mission statement, I don't know. You have to think about it. You have to think about the group and whether it will be a good team building. It will focus us. That's the key to all of this, the team building and the focus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a mission statement. It's a good idea. Mm-hmm. How else do we determine what we want within our context? Linda and others are saying by listening and incorporating others' concerns within what we want. Mm-hmm. By listening and incorporating others' concerns within what we want. Yeah, people might want the same thing, but they have concerns about it. They have worries. They have issues, right? Yes, this all needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed in a civil manner so that everyone feels that they have participated in the consensus and that their concerns have been heard and thought about, right? And a lot of times they're real valid ones. And sometimes they are concerns that can be put to rest fairly easily because we've thought of them too, is what it really is. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Listening and incorporating others' concerns within what we want. Mm-hmm. Mohammed and others are saying that we determine what we want by polling the group members so that we can get consensus. Yeah, by asking their opinions, by polling them. Yeah, Mohammed's actually voting for raise your hand. Yes, I like to do that. I like to know how we're doing and what kind of agreement we've got. I sometimes hesitate about actual raising of hands, but we can all nod, and then somebody can raise their hand and voice a concern, and then we can discuss whether or not that modifies things. Mm-hmm. And if not, how come, right? Who, what, where, when, and why? Mm-hmm. Yes, by polling the group members, because you need consensus. Yes. Mm-hmm. Zeal and others are talking about the 5W questions. Mm-hmm. The key to the 5W questions, who, what, where, when, and why, is that they are always available, want to know. You don't break them all out at the same time. You understand that, right? It depends what you want to know, right? And the main thing is we need to be wary. We need to be aware about the 5 questions for ourselves, too, right? Because we are models as leaders. We set a good example for civility. We never lose our temper. We never raise our voice. We never, God forbid, use a dirty word. Right? We are examples of civility. We are models of it. And we are examples of thoughtfulness, too, that we have asked ourselves the 5W questions. The who, what, where, when, and why. And we have answered them to ourselves and to the group, too. Mm-hmm. We will answer those questions for the group, for ourselves, so that we know what the basis is. We know what's happening. We know what is reasonable to happen in the future because we know what we're doing, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. Good point. Barbara and others are saying that one of the ways that you determine what you want is by seeking expert opinion. Yes, we're calling somebody else. We don't know. If we knew, we wouldn't be having the issue, right? We need to call in an expert. Now, nowadays, the expert could be online, right? But we need to be wary of the basis for an online expert opinion, right, for research. We have to think about where it came from and also not stop when we find something that favors our who, what, where, when, and why, our opinion. Not stop when we find something that favors us and to look forward to see if there is another side, if there's a side that doesn't favor us, and why, and who, and can we maybe contact them? They would be an interesting expert. An expert opinion is not always one that validates what you think. In that respect, the expert would be of no use because they're not third-party impartial. They just come to nod their head and say, oh, that seems good. That's self-affirming or something. It's good for your ego, but it's not good for knowing anything. We want to know all the edges. We want to know all the opinions. We want to know different scenarios. If we do this, what's the likely outcome? Yeah. And sometimes you just don't know, and sometimes you should call in an expert and ask anyway, because they might know something that you didn't know that you didn't know. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I've seen that quite a bit. Sometimes I actually have kind of experts that are in person, that, well, not, they're going to be on Skype, but you know what I mean. They're not just on the internet, whose opinion I value. Of course, I do. As you get more into the field, you kind of get speciality, so you know things. But I like to run it by an outside eye before we do something. Mm-hmm. Even if we're doing something that goes on a ballot, or rewriting a law or some sort of rule, some sort of corporate rules, right? We're doing a revision. I like to run it by a third-party eye who I respect the opinion of, because sometimes you're too close, right? You've worked on it a while. You've kind of fleshed it out. You've gotten the issues. You're kind of close to it. And you need somebody to step back and say, wait, no, I don't think so. That's good. That doesn't read like you say it reads. Yeah? I have that sometimes. We have that sometimes with when we're writing something, when we're writing a proposition, when we're writing an amendment, when we're writing a new set of guidelines, for example. And we know what it says. We've worked on the wording, right? It should always be run by somebody who has not sat there for hours and reached consensus and negotiated the wording. It needs to be run by somebody who acts as though they're a person who's going to be under it, a person who's going to be impacted, right? And see what they think it says. Mm-hmm. See what they think the meaning is. See what it is that they think they're supposed to be doing. What do they read that? You'd be surprised. Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't at all say what you thought it did to a third party outsider looking at it. Right? You got too close. You got too involved with the wording. And what it says is not at all what you thought it did. Yay, team. Yes. Mm-hmm. So you need to seek an expert opinion. And remember, we have done shows on experts. Prior shows archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Mm-hmm. And remember that we decided that an expert is someone with a great deal of experience and is not necessarily someone with a fancy degree. Mm-hmm. They might be, but an expert could be somebody who has done it before. Mm-hmm. I think one of the best kinds of experts is someone who has failed to do it before. Because I like to know what happened. I like to know their opinion. I like to know what they would have done differently. Yeah? And I like to let them join our group. Mm-hmm. Because they've got real field expertise. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes things do take a while. You know, the process takes quite a while, and there's some mishaps along the way. And a lot of times people who have been part of a less than stellar experience, They are very glad to be a part of one that looks like it's going to make it. Yeah, they are. They haven't given up. It's just that it didn't work, so they've kind of set it aside. But a lot of times they'd like to help, which is fabulous because they've got real insight. Nathan, others are saying that we determine what we want within our context, of course, by researching to see what others in this type of situation have achieved. Yes. And that failure is as instructive as success. That's the ticket. And, you know, now with the internet, it's very interesting. You can really find stuff out. Find out what people have done. Find out how it worked out some years later, right? Yeah. How perhaps it got changed or modified. Maybe went to court, right? And you can know this all over the world, which is fabulous because you can get ideas from everyone and everywhere. Yes. Yes, and don't shy away from looking at failure. I think it's sometimes even more instructive because a lot of times we're all taking the same path, and I like to know where somebody veered off and kind of didn't make it. Excuse me. I took a sip of water. It's a live show. What can we say? Yeah, but that's oftentimes, and the people who had the success would like to tell you all about it. And the people who had the failure have a real opinion as to why. Yes. And most of the time, they are still interested, and the people with the success are still interested. Good point. We might indeed join with the people who are having a successful outcome and become stronger on both sides. More numbers, more funding, more everything, right? Yes. It has to be beneficial to both sides, of course. Yes, but of course it will be. Yes. And so that's good, too, to make a multinational, perhaps, right? So that we can work together and we can achieve usually some sort of a justice, some sort of a good idea, right? Right. Yes. Good point. A lot of times there is now work on applications and other things to do with software, right? And like that, and with research, medical research, yes. Yeah, so there's lots of ways to all of us give our expertise and all of us add value, right? Right, yeah. So that's one of the ways that we get to do what, to get what we want is we collaborate, not only with the people in the room, but with the world nowadays, yes. So now that we've determined what we want as a practical matter, how should we proceed? We've determined how to know what we want. Now, what are we going to do about it, right? Yes. How are we going to proceed on this? Bowden and quite a few people are talking about creating teams with specific missions. Yes, a lot of times the issues are fairly broad, and we want to create more of a step-by-step. We need to divide a little bit so that we know where we're headed, and we know we can handle it, right? Teams with specific missions. Yes, people are asking for an example. And also Jamie and Nezzer are talking about reaching out to other groups to create alliances. It's kind of a very similar idea, to reach out to other groups, to create teams, to make alliances that are specific mission-driven. Usually this occurs when you've got a fairly big group and a fairly good amount of issue, fairly complex issue. It's a very good example of it. People asking for an example of kind of team-driven, alliance-based with other groups mission that did indeed get what we want and was successful. Because it is true that the bigger something gets, sometimes the more unwieldy it becomes. And it needs a central base of leadership, a central operation, so that people, so that somebody's keeping track is what it really is, and keeping everybody in the loop. Somebody needs to keep track, and it is a big job oftentimes. I actually think that if you can possibly do it, you could possibly get the funding. It should be done by a dedicated, paid person to keep track, of all the moving parts, to keep track of the of what people are doing, how they fit into the whole, that the whole can integrate what they're doing, and everybody knows what everybody else is accomplishing and heading towards the goal so that we can get what we want. Otherwise, things will get lost, and there will be a lot of very sincere, very wasted effort. And what good is that? You make people discouraged. They don't want to be in the group anymore. The group dynamic falls apart. You're not working efficiently. You need somebody to keep track of a fairly complicated, fairly large issue, a fairly large negotiation, something that needs to be fanned out in different areas with alliances and teams, right? Need one central point to put, to report into. I prefer that they be paid because it gives them more responsibility, right? Volunteers, they kind of come and go. Interns have a set amount of time and then they leave, and also they have no experience. They're gaining experience, right? And you need somebody with the experience and the ability. I'm very much for it. I actually have somebody that does it, but it's very important that they be well-respected and well-paid because they're invaluable. So you guys have asked for an example. Some people are giving examples. The biggest project and the most unwieldy and the most successful, because it had central leadership, even though it looked like everybody's doing their own, an enthusiastic volunteer leader who kept everybody going and everybody really interested, lots of funding, and lots and lots of teams and alliances and negotiations over years and years. So a big project, long process, not only many different types of many teams, but many, many types of people, cross-culturally, cross-language, cross-everything, right? And there needed to be boots on the ground, physical, besides, yes. And that was, you know, a lot of you know I'm a Rotarian. It is an international service organization. Its motto is service above self. We're all volunteers. And we do it because we want to make the world a better place. And somebody has to do it. Very large, very well organized. But it's organized into individual clubs. The clubs have somewhat autonomy. They pay dues and stuff to a central organization. But they're really kind of independent of each other. But they can reach across, and there is a great media platform and other ways to connect as Rotarians, right? So you've got the connection option. You've got the we're all in this together option. And we set out to eradicate polio from the face of the earth. Eradicate polio from the face of the earth. Wow. Now, it started out as a smaller project that was still something else. And it is being done within a generation, within a lifetime. It hasn't been that long. My dear friend Ezra Tishomi in the Seattle area is an American citizen, but he came from Ethiopia. His family and everything are there. And he saw what a terrible thing polio was in Ethiopia, in his area, And he saw in the United States that there is a vaccine to prevent people from getting polio that is a couple of drops, literally drops, in a baby's mouth. So you don't have to have hypodermics and knowledge and hit veins and stuff like that. Right, right. And he brought it to Rotary's attention, through the proper channels, that he would like to lead a project to prevent people from getting polio in his home area in Ethiopia. Now, that's a project in and of itself. There was a lot of negotiation. You had to have people travel there, had Americans travel there, and how to do it, how to get the vaccine, how to bring it, how to keep it. Well, at that time, it needed to be kept stable. As the project went on, drug companies made a better vaccine that was more stable and actually has a packaging that shows if the vaccine has gone bad, right? Fabulous. But that came later. And there was lots of negotiations and lots of suspicions, I suppose, and like that. But we went and did it, and it was so successful, we said, well, let's expand this. Yeah, let's expand it throughout all of Ethiopia, and then other places, like in the surrounding areas that still had a lot of polio. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And now I know the Gates Foundation has jumped in with some funding, and they're taking credit, which is actually kind of annoying, but we're Rotarians, so we're cool. And polio is nearly eradicated. But look at the amount of steps, the amount of teams, the amount of alliances to go into various countries to contact their Rotary clubs, explain that they were next, that we're coming, and explain how it is that it needs to be worked out and how we're going to get the transport or how we're going to tell the people to line up, how we're going to get accommodation, how we're going to get the vaccine itself, who's going to be there, when. Tremendous. And you know something? When you got, no matter where it was that we were going to do the vaccine and for the children, it was ready. The people were there. It was all set up. It was fabulous. Because a tremendous amount of negotiation and legwork to make what we wanted happen, which was to come and vaccinate people and to have big lines of folk carrying babies so that we could get them done, right? Yeah. And then it got into a bigger project and we actually went with eyeglasses because we made an alliance with a different organization, the Elks, and other people who collect glasses, prescription glasses. And, yeah, and so it was a whole big deal because we took all sorts of good stuff with us. Yes. Yes, the answer, people are asking about luggage. The answer is that there is kind of weight requirements, poundage requirements on luggage and like that. Yeah, the Rotarians came usually from other countries and also from the home country. They helped coordinate it too. We reached out to the local clubs in the home country. There's Rotarians everywhere, but those people who came like from the United States and other places, we actually filled our personal luggage with what we were going to need for the vaccinations and the eyeglasses and like that, and took very little clothing and things. Yeah, so just kind of put it through like that, and also had shipments. Mm-hmm. And the shipments were a negotiation in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. In the early days, we dragged it, and then there became shipments and like that, yeah, as the program became well-known. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's all that's alliances and team-building and negotiation over years. Different people, different cultures, different languages, different countries, different abilities to communicate, different media abilities, right? Yeah. Different sanitation abilities. Mm-hmm. And all needed to be coordinated, all needed to be efficient, right? Because it needed to be done. So we reach out all across to get what we want because we explain to people that we're coming with what they want too, right? Yeah, really did. And the Rotarian clubs all over the world understood it. Wow, that's fabulous. Yeah. Yeah, Hussein and others are talking about the use of media to help to keep all this going, to help to keep negotiations and enthusiasm and consensus, right? Also the use of media traditionally and non-traditionally. Yes, good point Hussein and others are making, that when you have issues that are getting media attention, as in news media, but not necessarily just traditional anymore, you need to have a spokesperson, right? Designate one. Because somebody who can really, really communicate what we're doing, what needs to be done, and why, in a very civil and cogent manner, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. The way the message is said makes a difference. Yeah, we're having kind of a weird example of that in the United States with our election, our presidential election, because one of the candidates could use some civility lessons. Yeah, he just kind of says stuff. You wouldn't choose him as your spokesperson, right? Yeah. You need someone who can really communicate your cause in a direct and sympathetic manner, or maybe even say, it's in progress, there's nothing to report, right? Right. But you can't have everybody just blogging and Facebooking and stuff like that while you're in the process, because it's going to be taken out of context. Especially if it's very disputed. And believe me, the people on the other side, which we're going to deal with in a civil manner, will be watching to see if there's something they can quote out of context, right? Right. I tell this to people right up front, do not put anything on the internet about what we're doing. Yeah? We'll decide when we're going to make a statement. We'll decide what's happening because others are watching, right? Yeah, the internet is public, people. And you don't want to have any question about it. You don't want to have an ugly surprise, right? Yeah, and have a sentence taken out of context. I've seen it done. It's really ugly. Yes. What else should we do to get what we want? Yeah, people, Eden and Andrew and others are talking about being sure to celebrate each success because it keeps the enthusiasm level up. Very big on that. I like to do it so that we understand that we're getting somewhere. Yeah, that because it seems like it's taken a while, right? Yeah, and it seems like we haven't gotten very far. But we really have. It's just that it's human nature to forget how far you've come, right? Right. So we have come quite far, and we want to celebrate that, right? Yeah. We want to be certain that we really understand that it is working, that we are getting somewhere. Yes. Yes, Suki and others are talking about creating a timeline. It's I think about the mission statement. If it's an actual written timeline with dates to set goals, you have to understand that it is modifiable. It's just something to keep us focused, right? Unless, and this is when I really do create a timeline, unless you've got something that's got deadlines, real serious deadlines, like getting something on a ballot, having to have signatures in by a certain date, having to have a fee paid by a certain date, that's a serious timeline, and that your administrator person needs to keep real serious track of. Yeah, I actually double keep track when there's an actual timeline like that, just to make sure we don't blow it. Some sort of a filing requirement for a court or something. There's some times in life when you've got a serious timeline that is imposed upon you, right? That's when you keep the deadlines. Yeah, that's a serious timeline. To create a timeline, just not a one that's an outside influenced one, you would need, of course, to be flexible about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, Dean and others are talking about flexibility on to modify what you want. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point that, for example, Raimundo says that sometimes you've got a changing outside circumstance. And people are talking about when the group membership changes. Yes, these things happen, and it does change the dynamic, and you need to be flexible in what you want. Because sometimes an outside event changes what's available. Mm-hmm. Might make it better. Might be able to get something more. Or it might you might have to think about what it is that's your core of what you want and how to achieve that and then modify upward from there. Yes. Yes, Hannah and others are talking about funding issues. Mm-hmm. Yes. And building, Lizette and others are talking about building a strong team by seeing each other as people. And as a team, really, as a team together. Mm-hmm. And yes, I have left a few minutes for the recipe because I know you guys like it. And a lot of times it is true that I lose track of time as leader of this group. And we have such fabulous discussions that I don't leave time properly for the recipe. But yes, you need to have some flexibility built in for things that happen. And I say things because they are usually kind of unexpected, right? They're kind of the unintended consequence type things. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, you need to be able to be flexible and to be not flummoxed, not undo as a group, right? Right. And that's where we're going to build ourselves as a team, and we're going to get to know each other as individuals and not just as symbols for the group we represent, for an idea, right? Right. And one of the ways the Recipe for Peace Now advocates is when we have timeouts, when we have breaks, which we do frequently, right? You can do them because the civility rules might be in danger. We'll take a timeout. You can do them just because we've been working for a while and it's time to kind of clear our heads. You can do it because you're hungry. But the food, we recommend having food in the room and having a potluck. And the reason being is that the food is a tool. It's to get us together. It's to get us around something that is not controversial, something that we'd like to do, something that we'd like to do together. How'd you make that? Wow, that's really good. Where'd you get it? Yeah. Leads to a convivial atmosphere, which is one of our goals, so that people want to come, so that people want to know what it is that we're doing, right? And the people keep enthusiasm. Now, if you're going to have food, and you are, you're going to need to take a survey. And the survey is, does anybody have an allergy, a prohibition, a religious prohibition to some sort of food, right? And then you will disseminate that information because we don't want anybody not to have a good time. Also, you will ask people to bring a list with them when they bring something. And the list is what is in the food so I can run my eye down it and see if I can eat it. Mm-hmm. Now, I advocate having a safe recipe, which is food that everybody would be familiar with, and it doesn't look like anybody is allergic or can't eat. And also, lots of times we have an adventure recipe. And an adventure recipe is one that is a little more unusual, mm-hmm, and is foods that sometimes people have a prohibition to. But we have taken our survey with our group, and nobody can't eat it, right? Right. Mm-hmm. Because this one's pork. Pork is oftentimes, I call it our adventure recipe because it's pork, and pork is something a lot of people don't eat. For religious purposes, for just purposes, they just don't. I must confess, I'm a big pork eater, so I can't say. But it is a consideration, and you must ask. So, we're going to do pork chops. Around here, you get pork in a, I must confess, in kind of a tray, a styrofoam tray with paper over it, at least I do. And I get it in a big store called Target. It's a big grocery everything store. It is cheap and easy, and they're pre-cut. I actually prefer the kind of pork chops, they're also somewhat cheaper, that do not have bones, because you can make more in the pot and they're easier to handle, and you don't have the messy waste where somebody has to chew on it and then have sticky fingers and stuff. You know what I mean? I'm big on kind of neatness and cleanup. But you do as you like. Let's have quite a few pork chops. They're cut into like half-inch thick slices, right? Depends how many people you have. I figure two per person, and then I figure more because I don't like to run low. And sometimes people would like more than two. Sometimes people would like one or none. Yeah, so it kind of works out. So I'm going to say let's have, what, depends how many people. This one is for about, this recipe you would double it if you needed more, is for about 4 pounds of pork chops, right, without the bone. I don't usually get the kind with the bone. So anyway. We're going to have that. We're going to have them cut into about a half inch thick slices, chops, right? Right. They're all kind of even in size, too, I must confess. We're going to have a nice big sweet onion we're going to chop. Let's have a couple teaspoons of quick cooking tapioca, which we're going to crush. It's going to make it thicker and sweeter. Just take my word for it. It's very strange. We're going to have 4 garlic cloves that we're going to mince. Let's have a couple teaspoons, well, maybe 1 teaspoon, of that dried Italian seasoning that you can crush. Sometimes it's called salad seasoning. It's all kinds of different kinds of Italian herbs. Oh, yummy. Mm-hmm. Let's have 2 nice big cans of stewed tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Not drained. We're going to use the juice, right? Right. Mm-hmm. You can decide to make this a little more spicy if you like. I do not. I leave the spices on the side. If someone wants like Tabasco or Worcestershire or something like that, I've got it on the side on the table because they can decide that. They can't make it less spicy, but you can make it. You can't make it less spicy once you put the spices in, but you can add. Okay. We're going to take our nice pork chops, which have been trimmed and like that. They usually come like that. We're gonna brown them on both sides in a hot skillet. You can use a little bit of oil if you like. I usually, because pork kind of has its own fat, I usually just spray the pan, the skillet, but you can use a little bit of oil all around. We're going to get ourselves a nice slow cooker. This is a slow cooker recipe. Isn't that fun? If you don't have a slow cooker, you can braise this. Buy a slow cooker if you can find one. I have the kind that's the most basic of all. I don't like the kind that clamps down and stuff. The biggest you can find, put the whole thing in the slow cooker. You'll need at least a 6-quarter for this. You're gonna need, because it has quite a bit of pork. Yep. We're gonna combine the onion and the little tapioca and the garlic and the Italian seasonings and like that. We're going to put in the chops. We're going to combine. They're going to be layered, right, because they're going in a slow cooker. So you put the seasoning in between each layer. You kind of spread it around. Now we're going to take our tomatoes. Remember those tomatoes in the can? Pour them right over the whole thing because we're going to use the liquid because it's going to cook in that. But don't put too much liquid because it'll go over. I've had that. Low heat, 8 hours. I don't recommend doing it on high heat. It'll make a tougher pork chop, right? Stick it in the morning 8 hours will go fast. You'll have food. It'll be fabulous. You can bring it right in the slow cooker, in the slow cooker pot, if you wanted to. You can even bring it there and stick the slow cooker on warm and warm it up. It'll make the room smell delicious. Oh, my God, I love my slow cooker. And, yeah, yes, thank you. That is a crock pot, yes. People are asking if a slow cooker is the same thing as a crock pot, yes. But it is not the same thing as a pressure cooker. A pressure cooker cooks faster, but it's just not as soft. If you do this right and you do this for the full amount of time on low, they will be fork tender, just delicious and fork tender. And it is, yeah, it's one of the reasons I don't do the bones is because they don't fit in the slow cooker. I don't have that big a pot. But, yeah, so I do the ones that are boneless. But, yes, it will be just yummy. Mm-hmm. Yes, as we speak, I actually have a slow cooker on. It's got a pork roast in it. So we are out of time. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you. Thank you for being here. If you want to find us, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Want to hear prior shows? They are archived on that website. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all of your participation. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.